Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. My guest this episode, sorry to disappoint some of you who thought that I got the English singer Sam Smith on the show to talk about motor racing. That'd be a little bit weird. Instead, it is my road and track colleague and my good pal, Sam Smith, one of the folks that I rate as among the most talented riders in the industry. He also does some really unique things that very few do, and he's been doing it for a while, and that is testing of race cars and writing about them. And really continuing a tradition that was broken for quite some time in print. We talk about a lot of that here. He has done, you know, everything from super vintage IndyCars from the 20s all the way up through to the, 1980 or so. He has tested Le Mans winning race cars. He has tested all manner of things that just are perfect for him as an amateur racer and a skilled amateur racer. And also is one of the finest people to write about this subject. You merge those worlds, and it's just magic. So that was actually the original premise for us to do a podcast. And then he went and got a TV show, which makes things even easier. It being Proving Grounds on NBCSN with our man Lee Keen, absolute rock star sports car driver who I've known for a long time. Parker Clearman, who I've known for a while, don't claim to know him well at all, but the three of them have a good thing going here, a really good thing, so we open up speaking about that, then get into Sam's word writing and car testing career, and it's a bit of a meandering thing because it wasn't meant to be a really structured podcast, just two pals talking about stuff, and we also get into the time he came to Indy and spent a couple of days with me and my man Robin Miller during the 500 and some of his experiences there. Fans sent in a couple of questions for Sam, so it's just all kinds of fun, for me at least, and I think you'll find a pretty funny cat too. I'll admit my jealousy right up front. He knows I hate him. He knows that I hate him with a passion. Why? Because he possesses talent that I do not, and I never will. He has helped me so many times with what I've contributed to Road and Track, been my editor, said, hey, don't do this, do that, and then I do that, and I'm like, yeah, that's way better. But then it doesn't become a natural instinct for me, but it is for him, and blah, blah, blah. But anyways, hatred aside, I love the guy. I hope you guys will love him too. And just wanted to offer a quick thank you to everyone who helped us cross the 2 million download mark for a little Marshall Pruitt podcast that kicked off in May of 2016. Took me about a year and, 7 months to get to 1 million downloads. We hit that right at the very end of December of 2017. And in 10 months, in about 8 days, we got our second million. And I am bowing, doing the Wayne's World I Am Not Worthy right now, just because I really appreciate all of the awesomeness and support that has been coming in for this little after-hours do-it-myself podcast as best I can. 2 million, I realize again that Joe Rogan and Mark Maron do that in about a half an hour with one episode each week, but at least in my little world of open wheel racing and sports cars, it's phenomenal. So, all right, I'm going to quit blubbering on. Let's get on with our man, not England's, but I believe Kentucky's, Sam Smith.
I'm a thorn in your side, Pruitt. It's what gets me out of bed in the morning, really. That's all I've got.
Now, the fact that you've got a new TV show, I think it's pretty amazing. Top Gear America, you, Tanner Faust, the guy from the NASCAR guy, Rutledge Wood, and I forget the other guy, Adam something or other. It just sounds eclectic to me.
It's amazing television. We've got the ghost of Dean Martin. Everybody comes out on stage. There's some skits, some drinking. Frank Sinatra tells a few jokes. It's amazing. You'll love it.
The overt racism. I think it's really the one thing we haven't had in these kind of the propagation of half hour to 1 hour shows. Can we look forward to rides being pimped?
Look at it this way. If you can't go on television to be a bad person in America, where can you be a bad person in America?
I'm just, again, man, all I need to be happy in life is an endless stream of resto mod Mustangs and Camaros going across the block. So I assume that's part of the script here. That's something that we're going to look forward to.
Well, there's that, and then there's, you know, the inevitable challenge where somebody has to finish painting it back from the body shop, otherwise they won't get it to the client in time, and then somebody's beard gets angry at somebody's tattoo. I mean, it goes downhill from there.
All right, man. Well, I think this is a pretty good podcast. We pretty much covered it all, dude. Thanks.
All right, well, ass hattery aside, we've had the good fortune, although we don't see each other as often as we would like, we've been road and track colleagues for a good while now. I've learned a lot from you. I've openly told you that you're one of my favorite writers of them, thar words on the page and whatnot. And now folks get to see the real Sam Smith on television, and I think that's a pretty cool thing. I also love the fact that you have the finest Pacific Formula Renault 2.0 prodigy in Parker Kligerman, and the world's sleepiest sports car driver, Layman Keen, a.k.a. Lee Keen, whose propensity for either being asleep, eating cereal, or driving a car, it's not binary exactly, but it's pretty close. He is at all times engaged of one of those three, according to his former teammate Patrick Dempsey. So how did this whole thing come together? And we're going to talk about other things. This isn't like a promo thing for your show. I just figure, hey, you actually got something cool that more than you and I and the folks inside the family are beaming about. But how'd this whole thing come together, man?
Oh, so the show itself is kind of a riff on an old Japanese 1980s TV show called Best Motoring, where basically a handful of race drivers and or, you know, tame journalists would go out and screw around on any number of Japanese race courses with any number of weird old Japanese cars. And there was a healthy element of kind of American Ninja Warrior about it. There's a lot of goofball weirdness, and they pretty much didn't have any adults in the room, so they did whatever they wanted. And a while back, one of the guys I've known for, hell, 10, 15 years, who's behind the show, used to be, he was associated with Jalopnik when I worked at Jalopnik years and years ago. God, that was almost 10 years ago. But he kind of built himself a pretty healthy career in a production company making car television and car-related television and car-adjacent television and YouTube-type stuff. A guy named J.F. Musial.
Yep.
He's behind, a lot of most people know him from Drive, the YouTube channel, which then turned into Drive, the TV show for NBC Sports. And it currently has Chris Harris and Mike Spinelli and a good friend of mine named Zach Clapp and a couple other great guys on it.
I enjoy that show.
It's fun, and it's funny because it's them being themselves in all manner of places, from, you know, the Alps to the middle of Europe to Africa to God knows where they end up. But NBC went back to him and asked him if he had any other ideas for a show, and he had this thing. He and another old friend of mine, Matt Hardigree, who used to work at Jalopnik as well, had a thing kicking around their head. They wanted to build an American version of Best Motoring, and that somehow kind of winnowed down into me and Parker and Lee, all of whom could not be, I mean, we're pretty much the three most different people in the world, but basically we end up out in the middle of nowhere, outside of Palm Springs at this racetrack called Chuckwalla, which is owned by, I think it's owned by one of the local SCCA chapters, but in the middle of nowhere, in the desert, pretty much doing whatever we want with a series of fast cars and putting them through stupid challenges and just being obnoxious. And if that sounds even remotely half adult, it's not at all, but you're right, man. Lee is he's about 11 feet tall and he's asleep half the time, and Parker is basically a teenage girl with a hair to match. So I don't know, somewhere in there I fit in, and we go out and it ends up being just filmed ridiculous in the middle of the desert. So it's a lot of fun.
And what is the title of it? Because I think I might have just panicked people by telling them that it is Top Gear America, which thankfully, at least knowing that that does exist as some sort of bar of reference, we can happily say it's not that.
Oh yeah. With all due respect to those guys, all of whom are great.
Let's not start the bullshit. No, you don't. That's a massive lie.
Shut up.
You,
shut
like
up.
Robin Miller, even like myself, we have a drastic hate for most.
They're okay, fine. So, the show is called Proving Grounds, and it airs, there are five episodes in the first season. They all air basically after NASCAR Cup races this fall. We've been through the main connection, I'm pretty sure, was because Parker hosts NASCAR America, and surprisingly is really good at it, because you talk to him and it's literally like talking to a 17-year-old blonde girl who had half a lobotomy, but yes. Really, really charming guy on camera. He somehow manages to turn it on. But it's called Proving Grounds, and it airs generally Sunday nights after the Cup race this fall. But
so that's
something,
very,
it is not Top Gear.
Well, but that's a very smart thing, though, and it's something that having even though NASCAR ain't what it once was, it still generates a fairly big ratings bump for anything that follows it. So the fact that NBC Sports was willing and wanting to place your show directly after NASCAR tells me that there is, well, I'm assuming here, maybe you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, but it sure sounds like they're wanting to give this show the best chance of success by dropping it in a place where the numbers are going to warrant signing up for second, third, fourth seasons, and so on.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, it's been really encouraging so far, because we went out in the desert and made our little show and then came back. And, you know, TV is one of those things that, you know, everybody in it has a little bit of control, but nobody has total control. So everybody, anytime you make TV, you always get just a tiny bit nervous because you don't know what's going to come out the other end, right? But something pretty decent came out the other end, and it's apparently done pretty well. NBC's pretty happy with it. So we're stoked.
The thing that I enjoy most about it, if we look at just the presentation of men, in this case, climbing in cars and doing amusing things for an audience, I really enjoy the 1980s aesthetic that I have seen applied to it, because having grown up in that Miami Vice pastel era, it just seems like, although the three of you are not exactly old and the cars you're testing aren't retromobiles, for whatever reason, this application of fonts and colors and graphics that appeals to that Tron era thing of the 1980s, it really seems to do something with the show that makes me wonder why other shows haven't said, you know, I'm not saying we're going to the 80s, I'm not saying we're going to any era, but maybe we could look at applying some sort of style that actually gave it a feel. Therefore, we don't solely rely on the cars or our guest hosts to carry everything with their personality. Is that something, at least stepping back and watching the show, seeing that layer applied and that feeling and sensibility applied, where you feel like, whoa, it's almost like a third actor involved here?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm, what am I, 37? I'll be 38 in spring. So I'm a child of the 80s, right? I was born in 81. And so all of that stuff, they threw it up there as a test just to kind of see if the show would format out. Because it's got, you know, there are weird little quirks and cues about it. There are VHS traces, and up in the corner there's a little play button, and you know, they've done some stuff to try and make it feel like an 80s video game, and or something you might pull out of Blockbuster in 1987. And somehow it works. I wish I could say it was a conscious decision other than just a handful of people getting around and deciding that it looked cool. But it's funny. I mean, it's like cars or any other story you're trying to tell. Feel is half the way there, right?
Let's talk about that a little bit, Sam. You and I have made a lot of fun over whatever amount of time of some of the rather rote guy turning wrench, oh my god, the boss is yelling at me, sweat dripping, the car has to be ready for the thing at the place with the stuff, and right, we that formula has been killed. It's been murdered and run over and flattened for at least 10 or 15 years, yet seemingly we can turn on some other cable channels, variants of the same exact damn thing. What was the talk like around the proverbial table on, okay, these are the tropes we are running away from, and did someone come in saying, okay, we don't want to be this, we don't want to be that?
Well, I mean, it's funny, right? Because anytime you sit down to make anything, it's always very easy to say what you don't want to be, to define something by the negative space around it. Whether that's, you know, whether you're engineering up a race car or writing a book or, you know, putting five words down on the page and calling it a haiku, right? I mean, everything in a situation like that, excuse me, in a situation like that where you're making something like a TV show that's so much a combination of the people involved, it can't be anything. But it really comes down to distilling distilling the stuff that goes through the heads of the people who are making it, right? And the thing that I really enjoyed about it was that all of it, we all had stuff that we wanted to see on television. And is Proving Grounds everything and that entire list? No. Is the show even what we'd like it to be? No. You know, everything is a work in progress. But ultimately, the funny thing about TV is that, you know, you get the same story anytime you have a bunch of people involved in a creative endeavor where there's a bunch of money at stake and a bunch of momentum and a bunch of time. You know, if you're not careful, you can get back to the easy answers real quick, because when there's stakes or weight on the table, you know, your first thought is, well, what if we lose this? The nice thing about me and Parker and Lee is that none of us have substantial TV careers. And, you know, we're given a little bit of rope with JF and his crew and had a great group of people to try and put something together that didn't suck. But coincidentally, you know, what we wanted to see was just something we hadn't seen before. And most of that was just reality. You know, the weird backside of reality TV that everybody knows is that none of it's real, right? Even the unscripted stuff is scripted. This is just three guys who happen to be a little bit alike talking about cars and car culture the way that everybody talks about it, you know? Most of the culture is not overly muscled dudes with big beards and lots of ink yelling at each other in a warehouse while a 67 Impala, you know, has to get out the door by Tuesday, right?
I think so, but again, I would firmly suggest... Actually, now that would be fun. Maybe you could put on some sort of play for an episode where that is actually the thing that you do. I bet folks would like that. Or an interpretive dance, something. A Mecum interpretive dance, something like that, since they're a partner of NBC Sports. The TV part is certainly one thing I wanted to talk about. The thing that I believe was the original idea of, hey, let's do a podcast where we just kind of talk and don't have any major agendas, with Sam Smith, rare automotive writer who tests race cars. And that's something that if we look back to 19, you name it, I think it came to an end for the most part towards the end of the 1980s, but if we flip open old issues of Road and Track, we will see the great Innes Ireland. We will see, pick some of the names of legendary race car drivers who went out and tested Al Holbert's Porsche 962, so-and-so's stock car, Formula One car. That was a really amazing thing for me growing up, reading about this, about someone writing a story about testing these cars that many of us just idolize the vehicles themselves. But there was also performance numbers and quantification done and curb weight and a technical drawing and this, all kinds of things. But that, you know, except for maybe once a year, it felt like for one guy in one magazine, there really hasn't been anybody who has filled that space until you became that guy and became that guy for us. And I don't know if you fully appreciate the fact that that is a space some of us were hoping to have filled. But just tell me about this Sam Smith guy who typity types keyboard. Yeah, great. But you also have really become one of our collective foremost people to step into race car A, B, and C and tell us what it's like to translate that into words some of us can understand.
Wow, well, that's flattering. First of all, thank you, man.
I didn't say you did a good job of it. I just said that you filled the space. Jesus, you're
No. Don't let me misunderstand. No, it's, you know, at the root of it, writing only works, and magazines and media, anything you build, anything you make, only works if it's rooted in a place of giving a shit, right? If you come from a place of curiosity, if you come from a place of emotion, if you come from, and that basically means writing, finding things to write about that you care about which you care to step back on grammar. I have an impossible, undying love for the stories behind motorsport. Possibly more of a love for the stories than for the actual practices of the sport themselves. Right? You know, I think the sport has, over the course of its, you know, basically century-long history, spent a lot of time getting lost in the weeds, not understanding what and how and why makes people care. What and how. Sorry.
Who, what, where, why, and when.
I got my words, and I use them on the typewriter, and they are good. No, not understanding what makes people care about it, right? And some of that is accidental, and some of that is on purpose, and some of it is, you know, sanctioning bodies putting their head in the sand. But at the end of the day, it's we're talking about no matter what it is, whether it's motocross or Le Mans or Paris-Dakar or, you know, Neil Armstrong driving a car on the moon, any of it all comes down to somebody, a human, in a machine making decisions. And sometimes people make the right decisions under pressure, and sometimes people make the wrong decisions under pressure. There's an old line that an old journalism professor of mine once told me, something along the lines of everybody's interesting when they win, right? The choices you make when things are going well are always going to be kind of sort of interesting, but those choices are never going to be as interesting as the choices you make when things are going terribly, right? Everybody's character comes out when they fail. And the great thing about motorsport is that it has a window into both sides of that equation. And there are inevitably, you know, by virtue of how it works, there is only one person at the top of the grid of every race. There's only one person sitting on the top of the podium, which means that you have somewhere between 10 and, you know, 30 or 40 people who failed. And whether that's a failure of engineering or logistics or personality or choices or courage or, you know, those stories are a mile deep and a mile wide. And I mostly just about 10 years ago realized that I wanted to try and tell them. And there were a lot of stories that either hadn't been told enough or hadn't been told in the way that I thought they should be told. And, you know, have been lucky enough to get into some of the cars that help tell those stories. It always comes down to really generous guys who own the sheet metal and who are willing to accept Road and Track's ample insurance policy, because we are, you know, anytime you put a race car on a racetrack, you're risking something. And them wanting to help tell the stories that make the machines what they are. You know, I'm fortunate in that I came up in club racing. I'm by no means, you know, the greatest shoe in the world or even my own personal zip code, but I came up in club racing and I'm confident enough to get into a car and not put it in a wall and get out of it and have something to say. And that's, you know, the funny thing about all this is that ultimately you have to be able to climb into somebody else's race car built for somebody else's time or period or company or goals. And just see the light at the end of the tunnel. If you're lucky enough to get into a seat and glimpse what driver X or engineer Y or chief Z was thinking when that machine came together, then you have a shot at being able to tell a story. And sometimes that, you know, that story works out and the piece ends up great. Sometimes it's, you know, not your best work, but it's a hell of a thing to be able to do. And we've been pretty fortunate to have the trust of some pretty amazing people to pull these things off. You know, several years ago, the stuff that I've gotten to drive, if you had come to me when I was 10 years old and say that I would at some point in my life slide Nuvolari's Alpha Tipo B, the one that he used to win the German GP in front of the Nazis. You know, if I would ever strap into one of the Rothmans 962s that won Le Mans. I mean, this is star maker stuff. It's impossible far side of the moon heroism, and it's a privilege to be able to look into that lens and try and tell the stories of the guys associated with it, you know?
You continue to use in your Road and Track column I don't believe you're actually doing the page formatting, but the photo of you, your avatar is of you sitting in that 962. That I recall being one of the first major things that hit the page that I recall. I think I might have helped source something for that thing as well, but it was you and James Hinchcliffe going the opposite way on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway using the road course, and I seem to recall there was some challenges involved there too, but I mean, a 962, you know, even though that car, I guess, its competitive life came to an end when you were in middle school, you still had the full feeling, full understanding of where that car stands in history among the greats. And I love the fact that even though you got a chance to test drive it, there's still that sense of, I believe, bewilderment or wonderment, some sort of mint left at the end of it, where it made a strong impression on you. What do you recall from that?
Well, it's funny, right? Because so much of, you know, I'm one of those people that takes, I take volumes of notes. I'm exhausted at the end of an interview or at the end of a test because I see a thousand things and I have the memory retention of a, you know, half dead squirrel. So if I don't write it down, it goes in one ear and out the other. So all I do is constantly write things down, which means that on the day of doing something, whether it's hopping into somebody's 962 or, you know, even if it's just testing a Camry, which we sometimes get asked to do, you know, that no matter what it is, you always tend to get lost in the moment of paying attention to something and not really recognize what it is and what you're doing and how special it is. But the 962 was that was one of those rare moments where I built it into the thing, and they, you know, you don't really climb into a 962. You kind of draw, the hatch opens up and the door is pretty large, but the actual hole into the cockpit is like any P car, right? You know, you have to shove yourself down. It's like falling into a submarine conning tower. And the moment you're in there, there's gobs of space and gobs of room, but it's not exactly a, you don't just open the door and then plop yourself in. And so I'm standing there in the pits at Indy, falling into this car I think it was on the pole 1 year. I forget exactly which tub it was, but it was on the pole 1 year at Le Mans, and then the next year one, or vice versa. But I'm falling into this car that went and did these things. It has never been broken, never been resprayed, never come apart. And it took me a second to get my legs down around the wheel and to get into the car. And as I'm kind of wrestling my legs around and moving past the shift lever and doing all the things you do to get into a race car that you've never gotten into before, I had this brief moment of clarity where you look around and you're just deeply humbled by what you see and how it's assembled. And it helped that this was an unrestored car. It helped that it was still in the livery. It helped that, you know, I knew and had read all the stories and all the books. I mean, you can't, if you're into this stuff, you can't not know what a 962 is. You can't not know that it came, the period that it came from. You can't not know about Norbert Singer and the guys that produced it and the engineering might it took to make that car happen. But all the weight of that hit me as I fell into the seat. And all I kept thinking was that, you know, at the end of the day, all of this was going to be over. And if I didn't consciously make an effort to look around and process it and appreciate it, I'd hate myself in the morning. And that sounds like a silly thing to tell yourself to do, but think about all the things that we go through. I mean, everybody's day job is a day job. Even no matter how spectacular it is, everybody has moments where you're just kind of on autopilot. And doing, we have some pretty amazing opportunities in the car magazine world, and it's hard to not just be like, this is really cool and we have work to do, let's do work. But that was one of those moments where you stop the clock for a moment and you look around, and it's, you are flooded with everything you know about that chunk of history and that piece of machinery. And it's funny too, Marshall, because about, I guess, 2-3 years later, I had a chance to test, Mazda North America owns one of the 787s. There are not that many. One of the 787s that ran at Le Mans. And they were kind enough to bring it out for us at Laguna Seca. And we did a piece with it and a GTO RX-7 and one of the two, although I guess this is the only one remaining left, RX-792 P cars, the Lee Dykstra GTP cars, right? That had one season and weren't that successful for a number of reasons, but were still amazing cars.
Great balls of fire.
Exactly. So the amazing thing was, and I didn't realize this until I got into the 787 2 years later, because really, who gets to compare those two things? You climb into the 787. The 787, if the 962 takes like 10, 15 seconds to get yourself in and get situated, the 787, you are fighting yourself into it. The cockpit is tiny, the door is tiny, the wheel is tiny, the seat is tiny. Fighting yourself into it for several minutes. And you look around, nobody fits it. Even the short guys don't fit it because everything's packaged up against your legs and your knees. And it's peaky, and the thing is twitchy and has a lot more spring in it than a 962. And it's, the power band is, you know, a millimeter wide, and every ounce of driving the car is impossible work. And I didn't realize until that moment just how much the 962 had been designed to make it easy on everyone. the air that was in the back, you know, making everything easy to reach for servicing, the room and the cockpit, how much work it was, even to do a, you know, a 7, 8, 9, 10th lap, how much the Mazda beat you up, and how much the Porsche was just kind of like, hey, buddy, you got, want to go drive around for a day?
Sure, yeah, we can do that. Bag. Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's not, none of which is to say that, I mean, could I go out there and rip off a pole lap at Le Mans in the late 80s in a 962? No, right? And I'm sure that at the absolute limit, when you, you know, when every hundredth counts, a 962 is just as much work to drive as anything else. But, you know, you look at it, and it's that kind of lens that I love. When you can look at a machine, and you know just a little bit of the story, and you can see through to the other side of the guys that built it, and the choices they made, and when and how they were frustrated, and when they were smart, and the culture that, you know, a 962 feels German. You know, there are bits of it that looks like they were laid out by the same guys who designed a, you know, late 80s Jetta or Passat. And a 787 is just as much a complex, what the hell is going on here, you know, many spined poison fish as, you know, a 90s RX-7. I mean, it's, there are so many things that you can learn if you just look. And I love, I can't tell you how privileged I feel to be able to try and pass on those stories. Because ultimately, that's the whole point. It's just sharing this stuff with other people.
Another thing I believe I've mentioned to you before, which it's a personal appreciation. Your passion for motor racing, the vehicles, and the stars, the legends, the truly exceptional folks involved. I've enjoyed when we've worked together on something, whether it's directly or just planetary general relation, it's been fun seeing your eyes open and breathe in many of the things that for me have become commonplace. I don't want to say I've ever lost that, you know, that true, the light and the, just the warmth that, you know, speaking with Legend A and seeing Amazing Race Car B, I'm still fed by those things, but there's just also a sense of familiarity because it's what I've done since I was 16, whether, you know, on the crew side or later in the media side, but that's been my donut shop every morning. And, you know, I guess it also fits my body type. After my millionth donut hole, it still tastes great. But seeing that kid plopping a donut hole in their mouth for the first time and seeing just that transformation of emotion and experience, that's a thing that I've really enjoyed observing in you when we've got to do cool things involved with motor racing. And I think, not speaking for your readers slash our readers, but I think that's one of the reasons why so many folks seem to enjoy what you write, because you have a very unique ability to bring that, holy cow, whatever it is, whatever those hundreds of little inputs that are being received in your brain, your ability to take those things and not neuter those bits, not water them down, not come across as the cool guy. Hey, yeah, that's right, I drove with this, and I was within 4/10 of the pro, and ha ha ha, and suck my balls. You know, there's the appropriate level of, I need to make this unfiltered and take that forward on the page, because that is exactly what everyone else experiencing this thing, whatever it is for the first time, would see and feel. When we were standing outside turn one at Indianapolis during Indy 500 practice 3, 4, 5 years ago, that was honestly, I mean, it always scares the living crap out of me because you have cars doing 230 plus miles an hour about a foot from you, but just observing you and the fact that you were treating these like, yeah, we're at the zoo, and I know that there's a little partition between us and the lions, but it sure looks like the lions could come across and eat us. You were keeping a healthy distance and kind of walked your way up and worked yourself into it, as you should, as the average person should. And again, I just think the lack of blasé, which I see and feel from many others who work in our industry and write the stuff that you do. Specifically, the fact that you have not allowed that to intrude, I think, continues to be one of your most distinguishing characteristics.
Well, thanks. It's funny. I always think, I mean, don't give me too much credit, right? I mean, at core, I'm a goofus, and I walk out and I watch somebody doing something loud and amazing and Herculean, and, you know, my heart falls into my stomach, and I fall on my knees, and I'm just, you know, jaw-dropped in the first place. But ultimately, for me, so much of it... Do you remember several years ago when Conan O'Brien lost The Tonight Show, and he gave a big speech at the end of it, and he stood there and he talked about all the things that meant something to him about making things with the people that he had been making them with.
Yep.
And one of the things he said has stuck with me for the longest time. And I remember hearing it and thinking, wow, if this guy looks at the world like this, after everything he's been gifted, earned, worked for, whatever you want to call it, then what reason do any of us have to be any different? And he looked at the camera and he said, look, if I leave you with one thing after all of this, and remember at this point they had just taken away The Tonight Show with him. He wanted his whole career to have the almost the most popular television show in the country, and finally got it, and then an eye blink later, they took it away and gave it back to Jay Leno. And he looks at the camera, and he says something, I'll screw up the exact words if I try to do it right, but it was something along the lines of, cynicism is evil. Avoid it, fight it, and run for it. Right? The notion that, you know, doubting the motivations of others or looking at something cool and being jaded about it just because you feel like that's how you need to be, I don't put any truck with that. And I think with you, it probably has something to do with the fact that anybody in your situation would look. It's a job, right? You get to look at some amazing things every day, and it doesn't matter who you are. Past a certain point, you have to get up and just do your job. And that means, part of that means not being amazed every single minute, because then you'd collapse and fall on your knees and not be able to get anything done like I do. But there's this whole thing about motorsport and racing and competition. You know, all of that is ultimately rooted in joy for most people. And I can't help coming back to that. When we were standing outside of Turn 1, what Marshall mentioned, several years ago, it was qualifying for the 500, and I'd seen cars run at the speedway in anger, but not since I was little, right? And, you know, one of the weird parts of my job is that we only have so much time, so there's a lot of stuff you have to process by not being there. But you invited me out to come hang out with you, and we walked out to Turn 1, and we stood there, and I remember the first car that came around, I think it might have been Hildebrand. First car that came around was just a little bit pushy on entry and just a little tiny smidge loose coming off, and went right up to the wall, and I was close enough and the air got pulled out of my lungs. And I remember sitting there thinking, first off, one, I didn't realize you could see push in an Indy car from ground level. Two, I didn't realize that, I mean, you never think about it, right? 200 miles an hour is 200 miles an hour, and that's moving a lot of air. And when you're close to it, it's going to basically turn your body into a husk. And three, you know, it was, you were sitting there explaining to me all the minutiae of an Indy qualifying day. And it was just this overwhelming thing, which is, you know, frankly, what the Indianapolis 500 is supposed to be, and what, in a lot of ways, we've done a real good job of keeping it from being, right? Whether that's through television coverage or jaded people covering it, or the cars evolving into downforce machines that don't move visibly, or, you know, there are a thousand reasons, right? But all I can say is that if you can look at this stuff, and if that voice, you know, because I know you, Marshall, you love this shit. You probably don't do yourself enough credit, but I know you still have the voice in your little tiny little voice in your head that just goes, this is cool, anytime neat stuff happens. And it I is. Think if you ever start, you get into a dangerous place when you start ignoring that voice. You know, there's enough negativity in the world and enough people who think they have the answers who don't. And I don't know. I think we could all do a lot more to listen to that voice a little more often, you know?
And I think you're hitting on something here, and this isn't meant to be the Sam and Marshall give each other BJ's podcast. But,
yeah, that's later. That's an hour from now, and that's private. I mean, it's not pay an extra $5.
That's a video, not a podcast, friends. I think you're hitting upon something, though, that I've been a glass half full guy for as long as I can remember. I know that you are highly inspired by the majority of things that you get to do. You're able to be selective enough to not be packed off to write about vintage Priuses and whatnot. I think that passion, I think the let's write about things that move us, not let's write things just because it might be popular or it might be otherwise. It seems like that's another motivator behind what you do. I know that that's a huge driver behind what I do, but I guess coming back to some of the bits that I think folks might have said, oh, I'm reading Sam Smith for the first time and I'm loving it. I'm coming back to maybe the 100th Indianapolis 500 in 2016 when Road and Track had a feature where Sam Smith drove four eras of Indy cars, and knowing that this is the huge centennial event, the fact that everybody at every outlet that knows that knew the Indy 500 existed wrote some sort of 100th whatever, there's a lot of folks challenging for that space, challenging for attention and eyeballs, and I'm going to ask you to do the heavy lifting on this, to talk about the four cars and eras and recollections, but rather than try and fill the book with, hey, we're going to go back to 1911 and do a written story about every year that ever took place at the Motor Speedway, you said, no, let's go get into the four most unique type of eras and evolutions of the Indy car that define the Indy 500, drove those vehicles, and then brought them to life, I would say in most instances, for the very first time, for readers to grasp and say, oh my goodness, you have to do all of that to hopefully, if God doesn't hate you, upshift that Miller from one gear to the other, or and so on and so forth. It was not a catchy, it was not a blinking lights, sell out whatever I can to get people to pay attention to our 100th Indy 500 contribution. I just thought that there was a real purity to it that was done in such a only Sam could do it kind of way. And the response that I've seen when that issue came out, and even in the years that have followed, I think folks really were blown away by how heavily they were transported into what you experienced. So tell me about that, and give us a run through of the cars that you chose, and then learned how to work with.
Well, so to back up a little, that came out of us. That story was. Basically the meat of an entire feature wheel. They were kind enough to give me almost all of the feature wheel, the center section of the magazine that holds, you know, the big, long, involving stories in for the May 2016 issue, you know, right at the 100th anniversary of the 500. And we wanted to do something really special with it. And so me and my boss, who, you know, Larry Webster at the time, my boss at the time, a guy named Larry Webster, who had come from Car and Driver and had spent several years at Road and Track. It's just one of the great guys in the business. We came up with the idea of trying to draw a line through the change of the race, right? Because the 500, if nothing else, for the longest time, it was marked by how the cars and the people evolved. And there were big, big moments where just large chunks of speed were put into the qualifying pace. And there were moments where it stayed the same for long periods of time. But, you know, we decided that ultimately, if you could kind of plot out the change points through the lens of a handful of cars and do something other than, oh, the car understeers, or this valuable museum piece can't be driven over than 60 miles an hour. If you could do something to talk about how and why the changes happened and how and why the people at the wheel of these things were dying or getting injured or, you know, accomplishing amazing things, then you might do something to kind of illustrate why the race matters. Because the 500, as it sits, is a unique beast in motorsport. It both where it came from, where it is, and how it got there, you know, and how it got between the two points. So the cars that we chose, and I'm making a very long story, not as short as it should be, but to do that, we talked to the Speedway Museum and a couple of other people and picked five cars out of, 100 years of history to try and trace that. The first one was a 26 Miller 91. Qualified at something like 111 miles an hour. And it was done up like, I don't remember the delivery on it, but like all Millers, it has varying history and the bits and bobs on it came from six different cars, but it was pretty evocative and an illustration of what things were like when, Harry Arminius and Leo Goosen ran the Speedway, when their cars were the fastest race cars in the country. These things were so evolved that Tory Bugatti later bought a Miller to pick it apart and make sure that his guys hadn't missed anything, right? After that, we ended up with a this was the thing, man. This was a hell of a moment. And as much of a sucker as I am for Millers, the second car was what got me because the guy who drove it is still around. We ended up with 61 Watson Roadster, a Travis Offey, basically a copy of a Watson. But it was a Foyt car. It was an AJ car. And it was completely unrestored because it had pretty much just been rolled in the museum shortly after its career ended. And you get into it, and the seat is covered in this weird spackled bowling ball vinyl. And there's a big vinyl drape next to your left leg to keep you from going too far into the tub. And the drive shaft is right underneath you. And that was that. That was representative of that great era in the Speedway's history. After that, we initially tried to pull the Clark Lotus, the V car, the Ford powered car, the four cam car that he had such great success in, out of the Henry Ford Museum. They were initially willing to help us, and there were a couple of schedule problems; they weren't able to. So we got a mutual friend of ours, a guy named Colin Comer, owns stock block powered 64 Isert, which was one of the many cars that came up after the rear engine revolution, with guys building stuff that were a lot like the Lotuses and Coopers that dominated, that had basically a Corvette motor in the back of it. And after that, we had the next one was a 72 Indy Eagle, done up in the Bobby livery that reset the record, with a turbocharged Offey in the back of it. And finally, there was I keep saying this, every single one of these pushes my buttons, but this one really, really pushed my buttons. The 1980 Chaparral that everybody knows as the Yellow Submarine, the first car to really bring body aerodynamics to the Speedway. And we got all of these things out there. And, because it was an odd day. It was late in the fall. It was the fall before the Speedway, fall before the 100th spring. Fall before the spring of the 100th running. And they were doing some construction. So, there were crews in the infield, and the awnings over the Main Street grandstands had been taken off. And we had a speed limit of 105 or 110 miles an hour, which if you've ever driven around on the Speedway in a minivan, you'll know that 100 miles an hour on the Speedway is basically walking pace. And, like in the case of the Miller wasn't even up on the cam in fourth gear. The Chaparral was, what's an 800 horse, turbo DFX? When does it start to make power? Whatever it is, it's not 100 miles an hour in top gear, right? But so we looked at all of this, and of course, these are all unrestored museum pieces. Some of them have been, they're all running. With the exception of Comer's car, the Isert, all of them had been pulled out of a museum and used for exhibition laps, but very rarely. So there was this very conscious notion of using these cars as a lens through which to view the event and the race, and not going out and trying to, I'm not going to try and back a Chaparral into turn one at pace to begin with, but B, not even thinking about trying it, right? So there was this wonderful, this kind of air of here is this amazing piece of history that has not been changed, that does not in any way do what it used to do, but you may crawl around it, sit in it, run it, start it, drive it, run it around the Speedway as long as you like, and try and learn something. And, on the surface, that's an odd concept, because race cars, the one thing about race cars is that they do not like to go slow, and they don't tell you anything about their behavior when they are going slow as much as they tell you about their behavior when they are going quickly, right? And all of them The funny thing is that in spite of that, all of them, you know, from the way you sit in them, the way noises they make, the way their engines work, the way gearboxes work, the way the Speedway looked from inside the cockpit, the way it looks piling into turn one at even, you know, even 100 miles an hour, there were so many lessons there. I think that piece ended up being 4,500 words of story, which for non-magazine people is something like 14 pages. Mm-hmm. I don't remember, maybe really more. But I could have written double that. I could have written triple that. If you asked me the right questions, I could sit here and talk until the day I died about just the yellow sub. I could never shut up, Marshall. I'm a giant nerd.
And we'd love you for that. So let's go back to the Miller. You and I have opined that, yes, it's great that docudramas like Rush about the 1976 Formula One season have been made, and they're great, and people know about it. We've got something new coming with the Ford and Ferrari wars at Le Mans. That's great. I'm waiting, we're waiting for the first person with the financing to step up and say, we need to make a Harry Miller documentary movie, because that man and those around him, I mean, he was not acting alone, but that man and that space in Southern California was, you know, that was our Apollo 11. That was our space race in the 20s and 30s, well, early 30s and such. But this is a man whose brilliance and the brilliant folks that he surrounded himself with, I mean, that it's just ripe for something, whether it's a PBS piece or otherwise. Good Lord, you and I have an immense affinity for the insane, just the truly insane year-by-year iterations. Hey, it's a little small four-cylinder. Hey, no, it's a big kind of marine eight-cylinder. Hey, it's rear-wheel drive. Oh, no, it's front-wheel drive. Hey, it's all-wheel drive. It's who knows what it is. There was never a resting point for that man, for Goossens, for et cetera, et cetera. Getting to climb in and not just ogle at the cam covers for a 91 cubic inch Miller motor, but actually getting to climb in and push and pull on levers and stomp your feet and try and make that thing move. I think that's what I took away most from what you wrote about that experience, that the almost synthetic experience today. I open the door, I climb in, I buckle in, and with my hands on the circular device, I have everything I need, more or less, to go fast. And I only really need two pedals for my feet, but essentially things are so catered towards ease and speed that actually going 100 miles an hour in the opposite direction of who exactly did you expect to manage all of this and do more than get out of first gear? I just loved the little trips and blunders and the come on man approach to trying to get that Miller just to work and function as a motor racing vehicle, much less picturing it doing 500 consecutive miles.
Well, I mean, think about it, right? You know, again, it comes back to story, and you know, you look at Miller, and it's no exaggeration to say the guy was our Bugatti, and Bugatti felt like he could learn something from him. You know, the two Packard Cable specials that were shipped over to Europe. One is now in the Smithsonian, and the other one's in the Indianapolis Museum at the Speedway. But those two cars were shipped over to Europe, ended up passing through Ettore Bugatti's hands because, you know, in the 20s and 30s, if you were at all involved in the world of speed, you knew who Harry Miller was. The man's cars dominated the Speedway. You know, Goossen's work, Miller basically came up with the ideas, and Goossen and later, you know, the guys at Meyer Drake, turned his ideas into stuff that literally was, you know, the fastest stuff on wheels in much of the world. You know, these were 140, 150, 160 mile an hour race cars. A 91, you know, that's 91 cubic inches. That's a liter and a half. It's a straight eight. The pistons are smaller than teacups. It makes 150 horse, and it even getting it away from a stop, and I'm not talking like, oh, it had a crash box, oh, the clutch was harsh. You know, even getting the thing away from a stop was a challenge. And I don't mean like, can I figure this out? Oh, I figured it out. Now it's easy. every single time the car is fighting you. The car fights you in a straight line. It fights you under the brakes. But then once you get it up onto something like a plane, you look around and you realize that, you know, for a long period of time, the guys behind the wheel treated the speedway and the board tracks and all the dirt tracks and the, you know, anything paved, they treated the speedway like a giant ice rink. And these, you know, you see pictures of guys being flung over the top of the board tracks in places like L.A. or New York, and you know, literally being catapulted to their death because there were no guardrails, and or you know, one of the boards would pop up and the tires would dig, or God knows what happened. These were jewel-like pieces of machinery built for a world that did not yet know that that was how you built race cars. Mm. And the guys who drove them, you know, you don't want to elevate any one group of heroes over, you know, era of hero over any other group, era of heroes, right? But the guys that drove them, you know, that era was just as deadly as the 60s and the 50s. And the cars were much less of a solved known commodity. It's fascinating, right? Because that car, all it did was point to a time when, for me at least, climbing into it, you know, and even that is a problem, right? You fall into the seat, and then you literally have to thread your legs. You thread your legs around the drive shaft down onto the base of the bell housing, and there is not more than an inch of space from the top of your thigh all the way down to your ankle. If you wanted to get out in a hurry, you would be hosed, right? But you sit there, and the wheel is in your chest, and the engine sounds like, I can't describe to you what, you know, teacup pistons with a giant supercharger on them sound like at 5,000 RPM, but it was this weird, snarly, tiny little thing that in every way was designed to do one job. And you look at it and realize that there was a period when all of that was rooted in this race, right? When everything came out of the speedway because the speedway was the reason for making something faster, for guys dying. And it was this weird little lens into the notion that we once believed this stuff to be extremely important. And maybe that's why it hit home so much, is because in my gut, I know that it's important. And knowing that there was a time when, like, that was one of the levers that moves the world is a hell of a thing. And it came out of, you know, Miller and Goosen worked out of a tiny, tiny shop. And, you know, it was just as much a little romantic story as the beginning of Alfa Romeo or Peugeot or anything else. The difference is nobody in America knows who Harry Miller is anymore. And God, if there's ever a movie and I don't see it a million times, I have failed at my life.
Well, no need to wait for the end of your life, but you know, I think I've come up with something new we can pitch here. The lovely 3-lap reviews feature on Road and Track with you and our boy Travis Okolsky. I think we have a new series to pitch. Sam climbing into and complaining about race car cockpits.
I'm an old man and my knees hurt. This is stupid. I don't like it. Yeah. That's exactly what I sound like every time, man. You know how it is.
And I apologize for the buzzing. I just got texts from young Pietro Fittipaldi, who was answering a rather benign question that I had. But, you know, I wish I could say that I had some giant studio here, which everything is perfectly walled off, but it isn't. It's just my office. So, one of Parnelli Jones' great stories about mastering the Roadster formula at Indy, this is also combined with tire technology evolution that would allow such a thing. Parnelli speaks about getting a proper grasp on the Roadster formula and then whooping the living daylights out of people with it once he figured out that drifting was a possibility, but then also an advantage. And it was by, you know, I'd love to see, I wish we could go back in time with full 8K HD cameras and capture what was happening to the right rear tire at turn one, turn three, whichever, and see this spring rate that he speaks about. And it's not spring rate in the vertical sense of compression. It's also, I think, partially dragster-like deformation, if not slightly bending under the rim, under the weight and forces of cornering, but it's effectively Parnelli talking about getting to a place where he could turn into the corner, get the car to start to slide, and there was just a point where this weird drifting tire folding deformation would happen, and then it would spring back, and he would be able to launch forward again and accelerate down a short chute or the front straight. But it was this just amazing concept, Sam. I know you weren't able to do it with a 105-mile-an-hour restriction, but it's this amazing phenomena of, hey, there's a new Amazon or whatever Netflix feature about Ken Block's Gymkhana series and how he's doing, and he's hooning in a Mustang, and look at all the smoke and sideways stuff, and you go, yeah, that's cool. Is it cooler than Parnelli frickin' Jones telling us about, pick the year, 1960, 19 whatever, at Indianapolis, drifting a freaking roadster through the corners and just murdering everyone else on the stopwatch? Sorry, Ken. I'm going to go with Parnelli Joe. Rufus is always going to win that conversation. Tell me about, I guess, at least the romantic notions and visions you had in your mind of what it was like to sample a roadster, even if you couldn't do your best Parnelli Jones impersonation.
Well, so here's the thing, right? And for those, I can't imagine there's anybody listening to this who doesn't know what a roadster is, but just for a basic sketch, there's an offset off the up front, you know, that same four-cylinder that ended up running the Speedway for decades. It was actually rooted in Harry Miller's efforts, right? An offset off the up front, giant, you know, massive wheels and tires. Tires that now, if you saw them, would assume they came off of a pickup truck that was 30 years old. Something like a 70, 75-gallon fuel tank behind the rear wheels. And your ass is about 2 inches in front of the rear axle. And so you climb into the car, and you look to your left, and you look to your right, and literally level with your ears, because you sit so low, are the tops of the tires. And it's to the point where, like, you can tilt your helmet and scrape your helmet on a rolling tire, right? And all you think about when you climb into it is, holy shit, if I hit anything, and it's not so much like the Miller, right? If in the Miller, you sit there and you think to yourself, well, if I hit anything, I'm being A, chucked out of this, and B, turned into mincemeat. In this, if you hit anything, the car is big enough. It's a giant kind of bathtub formed thing around you. The wheels are right there. All you think is that if you hit anything, you're going to be fine, which is, of course, not true at all, right? It is the furthest thing from the truth. But there's enough space around you, and this big steering, you know, this big bus-like steering wheel that's canted forward at, like, 40 degrees or whatever the hell it is, and an enormous shift lever down between your legs, and the car feels big and safe, and you sit in it, and you can completely, you have this kind of wake-up moment from the moment you bend it into a corner, how it picks up the throttle to how it reacts to the tires moving around, even way, way south of the limit. You know, it's this wake-up to, that's exactly what the guys were doing. They were chucking them in and skating them around the place. And you can see how you'd get an awful lot of pace out of a roadster just shy of that moment, and that whoever could shove it over that knee point, whoever could make the thing, you know, really truly be at rise up on plane at, you know, whatever the hell monster speeds they were doing, that guy or gal would be yards ahead of everybody else. And the car is so, I've never met anything that was at once so, like, thick-necked, broad-shouldered America, and also, like, hey, pal, put an arm around your shoulder, pull you off to the corner and tell you how it really is, right? There was a weird transparency to that thing that you don't get out of a lot of machinery or people or moments, but it was just, it sat there and it spat out this weird little picture of exactly the way things were. You know, that's the funny thing, right? I mean, the best of the things we create come from a very specific moment in our history and are designed for a very specific task and don't work outside of either of those things. And a roadster is a lot like that. You know, once it lived for roughly a decade at Speedway, and once the rear engine cars came along, it was done. But you climb into it, and all you think of is guys, you know, it makes you think of all these weird 50s movie cliches, guys breaking off pool cues over their knees to go get in a fight. You know, somebody with meat hands in prison, you know, telling you how it is. I mean, any movie that ever starred James Dean, I mean, there are so many things that ooze from that piece of machinery. And at the core, it's like you said, right? It's how the tires worked, how that silly-ass frame worked, how those dampers worked. I mean, the steering links on a roadster are thicker around than my wrist. And granted, I have, you know, say, limp, you know, silly rider wrists. I don't actually go to the gym. But you could have brained a man with a steering link on the thing. Every part of it was substantial. And it was such an eye-opener, Marshall. And so much of it is rooted in, like I said, how the tires work, how the thing works. And it was just so designed to do exactly that. I love the Rufus anecdote. Is that in print somewhere? I need to go find it.
I believe so, yeah. I know it's in print somewhere, and it might have even be in video form with the Mount Rushmore video that Robin did. What, 5-6 years ago? I don't know if you've seen that, but sat down for an hour at IMS Productions with Dan Gurney, Mario Andretti, Rufus, and I'm trying to remember. Oh, it was supposed to be Foyt, but Foyt, in typical Foyt fashion, didn't want to turn up because Mario was there. And Robin's like, it's right across the street, right? The main entry between the short chute between turn one and turn two, like, you just go straight across the street and you're at the IndyCar offices and IMS production. Like, all you got to do is drive a half mile. And now he one of the, granted, they've only because of AJ, and I think his 97th introduction to Jesus, only around introduction 95 or 96 with whatever hell scare or deadly bee attack that he survived, has he decided to soften in that department and is actually, you know, being somewhat civil and warm towards Mario. But 5, 6, 7 years ago when Robin put this together, he initially said yes, then said no, just because Mario was going to be there. So anyway, video, Rufus tells that story. But if not, I know I've written something, interviewed him and written something about it. So I'll find that.
I love how you just casually toss off all the moments that guy has cheated death. I like to think that the next time death comes for him, it's going to be all of them combined, right? It's going to be a large swarm of killer bees driving a tractor, you know, running him down on his farm. I hope the guy is with us for decades, but you have to admit that on some level, like, every single one of the stories is pretty great.
Well, the what you mentioned, though, about the Roadster, it fits not only the time, but the man that was developed in that era as well, because it was really IndyCar racing's first brawler era. And I'm not saying that they necessarily all jumped out of the cars and fought one another, but when you look at an AJ Foyt who came to prominence in this era, you know, that's a punchy SOB right there. I mean, that guy would fight himself if he could. You look at, and Parnelli, by comparison, is, you know, definitely noticeably smaller than AJ, but Parnelli is the one that everyone was afraid of. Even though he was not super physically imposing, there was just a sense that he wouldn't stop until you were dead. And there are a number of other guys like this who, you know, again, you have these stereotypical images of a guy chomping on a cigar, only begrudgingly putting on his helmet because some official wouldn't let him go on track until he did, you know, while still trying to finish off the last half pound of a bleeding red steak. And just this real, you know, wife beater t-shirt kind of sensibilities. And to think that the cars matched, I don't know, evolution wise, Sam, if it was a case of the cars demanded a type of driver coming out of dirt track, oval racing and such, and there was just a kinship in driving style or needs where this is really where you started to get these kind of He-Man type drivers who made the most out of them, or if it was just pure coincidence. But I do find it interesting that you think back to some eras at the Indy 500 and the drivers definitely fit, you know, the rather effete types. There are eras of cars where you go, of course, the guy with the scarf around his neck and the thinly trimmed mustache would be driving in that era. And then you think about the Roadster era and you go, yeah, there weren't many guys who would lose a bar fight, who succeeded in those cars. So I just love, you know, can't say if we're talking nurture or nature, but I love the fact that at least if we were casting for something in that era, there's a perfect fit visually between the cars and the men who climbed in and did crazy things with them.
Well, I mean, I think it's like anything else in human history, it's probably a combination of all of it, right? You know, the notion that you know, for the longest time, the route to the speedway was up through dirt, and you know, you saw the cars. Even a Miller has its roots in dirt, right? You know, never mind a Roadster, which is in many ways, you know, a sprint car with a bunch of roids under its hood. I mean, there are so many lessons from just looking at, you know, say a Watson and a late '60s Lotus side by side. But what I found really, really interesting was that you could seize a moment, not just in how, you know, how the cars worked, but in how they were constructed and how the speedway changed. You can see the moment where it stopped being a sport that guys, you know, where guys battled the car with their fists and their forearms and started being a form of low level flying with really tiny control inputs and
fingertips,
right? And that's the thing, you know, where, because like that Isert, for example, or, you know, of course the Chaparral, right? There was a moment where the cars became accurate enough and high resolution enough that if you did, you could go around the speedway with inch precision. You know, you can't do that in a Miller simply because the thing is designed to move. You know, a Watson is designed to move. The Sub, or, you know, a modern Dallara, those cars are designed to be as accurate as possible. And they take that driving style, and you talk to the guys who ran them at speed, and they say that they take that driving style. Now, there was one of my favorite quotes that I found, I dug up while researching the Chaparral, came from Rutherford. You know, he said that, you know, in the 2K, in the Sub, the edge of the universe was a lot shallower. The car felt smaller. The track felt smaller. Everything felt more of a narrow envelope.
Wow.
And it amazes me that you can look at them and see that, because I can't think of a single other human endeavor where so much is packed up in a single piece of machinery for so relatively little in exchange, right? I mean, even the 500, you win the thing, and yeah, there's money and fame, but at the end of the day, you just drove around in a circle more than a bunch of other guys did, right? It's not wartime. You're not, there is no greater existential cause here. We're not saving anyone. We're not, you know, vanquishing evil from the earth. It's a sport. But you get so much out of thinking about what was going on in human history at the time and what, you know, the world that the cars came from. And that's, you know, to get back to what we were talking about earlier, that's what I love about all of this, is that ultimately these stories were not, the big mistake I think that people make is assuming that these stories were created independent of everything else that was happening in the world at the time. You know, it's like everything else we do. It's a tapestry, you know. Floyd was living at the same time and running at the same time as the Cuban Missile Crisis, as, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic, you know, Chapman and Cooper were reinventing the world. I mean, there are a thousand things happening, and the cars are just a piece of that. That's what's so great.
So the Collins car, Colin Comer's car, I mean, it did not make the show at Indy, but I'm still curious, coming out of rear-engine cars, I apologize, front-engine cars, was it immediately transparent that there was something vastly different dynamically with the rear-engine Indy car, with this chassis being the genuine jump from the Roadster you were in? Or was the fact that it's still rather high ride height, tolerances and such, you know, there's still a lot of movement involved, less movement than a Roadster, but just curious, even at the speeds you were limited to, if there was some sort of ding, 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 wow, big advancement, or not as much?
Well, so to put this in perspective, an Isert looks a lot like a 60s, well, it looks a lot like most of the mid-engine cars from the right after the revolution of the speedway, but which is to say it looks a lot like a 60s Lotus British Formula One car, right? It's a small cigar. There's a Chevy small block in the back of it, and the nose is lower than the middle of the cockpit, which is lower than the engine cover, right? And these, the Izard itself was, it turned out, you know, we wanted the car. We wanted the Jim Clark, the Lotus that he won with, right? But it turns out that the car we got was a lot better lens through which to view that period, because that was pretty much one of the last moments when a guy with a garage could build something and go and have a shot at the show, and he might not make it. And the guys who built the Izard did not make it, right? That car was a copy of kind of a cross between a Lotus 18 and a Lotus 24, both of which are Formula One cars, right? But they built it, and they went, and they tried and tried to qualify, and they did not make the show. They were not in the field. But you look at it, and you sit in the thing, and even by virtue of how it's built, right, if for nothing else, they could have gotten the suspension, the steering geometry wrong, weight balance wrong, you know, everything about the car could have been wrong, and you could still plop into the worst mid-engined IndyCar, mid-engine 60s IndyCar in the world, which, again, an Izard is not. It's just not one of the big dogs. But you could still plop into that and see how that changed. You know, the steering was impossibly light. The nose, because the motor's in the back, and because they were, you know, at the time, the cars had nothing around the driver except a couple of fuel cells, and, you know, the pedals were essentially the first thing that hit, like any car from that era, if you punch it into the fence. You can see everything, and you know where every last inch of the car is, and the way the steering geometry was set up, it was much more nervous than the Watson. It, you know, it leaped into a little bit of lock. It loaded everything more quickly, but it also felt far more comfortable, like any mid-engine car versus any front-engine car. You're that much closer to the polar moment, or to the center of mass in the thing, that everything it does is just kind of hosed into your spine. And there was, you know, you could sit in an Izard or any IndyCar from that period, right after everybody decided that, you know, hey, the motors need to go in the back. You could sit in any IndyCar from that period and see that. And at 80 or 100, you start to feel it. And the cars are, you know, it's just as nervous and just as set up to turn as a Watson is. It just works massively differently, right? And that's what I found so interesting about it, was that, you know, ultimately, there was a time when every season in the sport, guys were figuring out massive leaps. Even in Indy, which was arguably for a bit behind, you know, behind the continent in terms of tech development. And that's one of the things that I think we've lost from that race, is the sense of, and motorsport in general, is the sense that, you know, there's some kind of envelope being pushed, that guys are trying things and breaking things and learning things and failing and genuinely moving the goalposts. You know, that was a period when the posts were moved every month or two, much less every season.
Well, speaking of posts being moved, I loved your description of the Satan's hair blower in the turbocharged Miller Eagle. The power possibilities within that machine, which I really wish you had defied all strictures there and said, nope, I am lighting this up. I want my 1,000 horsepower. That vehicle, just listening to Uncle Bobby, listening to Bobby Unser talk about it, is so, it is just, yes, one of the great things in life is listening to Uncle Bobby talking about that car and the power that it made, the developments that made so much power, plus its downforce capabilities and so on. This, to me, while you were not able to have that thing screaming and bellowing and just glowing red hot behind you, I know that if you'd been able to, this would have been the most extreme machine you'd ever sampled. And I don't care what it is today that you could climb into Lewis Hamilton's new championship-winning Mercedes Formula One car, and this Eagle Offy Turbo is still a brick bat to the head.
Well, so, I mean, think about it, right? So that motor, that four-cylinder, the Offy that basically dominated the Speedway for decades, is essentially one of the Miller-Goosen designs. It's a shorter version of the Straight 8 that they, and, you know, that they also later ran as a 4. You know, so it has its roots in the 20s, and it just kept getting larger and larger and larger, and then they threw a hairdryer on it and figured out how to keep it together with a bunch of boost in it. But, you know, it's a 2.6. A 2.6 liter four-cylinder without a balance shaft, so all it does is vibrate your teeth out. And with the boost turned all the way down, it makes only 800 horsepower. And it has about three blocks worth of lag in it. And you go back and you read interviews with guys, you talk to Bobby, and, you know, those guys say that when the cars, even when the cars had a head of steam on them, and that, you know, the power band in them was tiny, but even when they had a head of steam on them, you know, you would make throttle changes a corner out, you know, because you knew the car was going to be that far behind you. But what was it? I mean, it was something like 17 miles an hour that they punched the record up that year because of the gurney flap, yep, and aero changes. I mean, it was like 195 or 196 miles an hour that thing clocked around the speedway. And it's, you get into it, and the car stops at your hips. There is nothing but plexiglass above that. The aluminum, you know, because it's an aluminum monocoque, it comes right up to your legs. I mean, if you imagine, stand up straight, put your feet as close as they can together, and then try and make your knees touch. And that is how it feels to sit in a 72 Eagle Indy car. And on top of that, you have this monster, like the world's largest Hewland. You have this monster gearbox with gears the size of coffee can lids in the back. And all the thing does, I mean, all it does is spit out that it wants to eat you alive, and it wants to put you in the fence, and it wants to do big old nasty crazy things, and it smells like the, you know, the weird-ass cocktail of fuel that they ran. And there's just 1,000 things that should dominate the experience, but at the end of the day, all you do is get in the car and you think about that motor, because it's this big, gruff, huffy thing that, you know, makes building moving torque way the hell up top and wants to be treated one way and really doesn't like it when you do anything else. And I mean, you want to talk about like seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. I have no idea what it is like to do 196 miles an hour around the speedway in a 72 Eagle, but holy hell, I'm scared of it, right? And the funny thing about so many of the cars that we get to test, Marshall, is that there's a lot of shit that you get in, a lot of stuff you get in and you think, yeah, you know, if I had the training and the skill, I would do this and I would risk myself and I would put it all together and that would be fine. And I climbed out of that thing very, very glad to have never been put in the position to say yes or no to trying to take a crack at a lap at it. Cause it is a beastly thing in a way that nothing I've ever encountered in this gig or seen anybody run is, right? I mean, there are elements of that car that make, you know, a 91730, that make 1,000 horsepower Can-Am cars seem puny. It's a hell of a thing.
Someone asked me on Facebook, knowing that we were going to do our podcast, to ask if you recovered from the visit to the Mug and Bun with Robin and myself a few years ago. Are you still kind of pissing 1040? Or I don't know what grade oil is still left in your body.
I think pieces of the Mug and Bun, I think it's like kidney stones. The Mug and Bun lives with you forever. You go there once and it's in you and it's not going to come out, you know? What a great place that is. Also, it terrifies me because all I want to do is sit there and eat. And then I would never leave and then I would die there, but I'd have a lot of Mug and Bun in me.
Watching you listen to Robin just be Robin was also another, I mean, that I should have been filming it just to see your face, so you could see your face.
It's so great.
And the thing is that here's the thing that angers me to no end with Robin. That was just a, whatever it was, Thursday evening for an hour with Robin. There's no preparation, there's no setup, there's no artifice. That's just normal life for Robin. I hate the fact that he is the world's most interesting and funny and hilarious man with an iron trap for a memory. Just stories just flow from him in perpetuity. It's just, again, I just love seeing you getting to experience Robin for an hour and what I just, you know, have enjoyed for free for countless number of years. But it was fun seeing you go like, holy crap, this is a real human being. I don't know, I don't know how this isn't an animatronic thing that's been pre-programmed for my enjoyment.
Well, because you see Robin on TV, or you read his work, and I've read his work for years, long as I can remember, or you watch him interview somebody, and you think, oh, okay, like, this is what the guy is like when he's on. Well, it turns out there's no off. It turns out that's just Robin all the time, and there's no, like, I always wondered if he just went home and did massive amounts of prep, or if he just pulled all of those facts out of his nose. But it turns out he just, you're right, he remembers everything. And everybody, you know, we were sitting in the media center that year, and Uncle Bobby walks up and sits down and starts talking to him like they're old pals, because, of course, they are old pals. And, you know, but everybody has that respect for him, whether it's Uncle Bobby or Franchitti or Bourdais or, you know, Alexander Rossi. Everybody knows Robin. And the great thing is that the Robin you see or hear on television or radio is exactly the same Robin you get 24 hours a day when you hang out with him. I love the guy. He's amazing.
Let's talk about one or two more things, brother, before you and I both move on to the rest of our days. You don't get to do as many racing hero profiles, day spent with a legend type things I know you would like to. But what are a couple that you've been able to do in recent years where you're like, okay, that was just me sitting on Santa Claus's lap. Holy cow. how did they let me do that? And B, why hasn't that man told me to go away yet?
It's funny, that list is, we don't get to do as many as I would like. I'm fortunate that list is longer than I think I probably deserve. But it's also funny because there are guys that fade into your memory, and, you know, at the time you talk to them and you think, wow, that's amazing. And then there are guys that that's amazing. And then, you know, a week or two later, it's a little, memory's a little fuzzier. And then a year later, you kind of forget that you did it. And then there are guys that always, always stick with you. Mario is one of them. You know, we spent a day with him several years ago at the Speedway, just talking and chatting, and put together a short interview out of it. But one of those guys that is exactly, you know, he's a Miller. The person, he's a Robin. The person you see in media anywhere, the person attached to the legend, is exactly who he is in person. And he's self-effacing and humble and all these things that you would think that Mario Andretti should not be, and that just makes him even more endearing, right? And, you know, the one and only time I got to talk to Rick Mears was also at the Speedway, but I remember standing there listening to him talk about what it takes, because we were talking about, had this long interview we were putting together on what it takes to coach guys who have never run an oval before. You know, Rick is, I mean, the guy is the epitome, everybody always calls him the epitome of California cool, right? But he is. He stands there in his sandals with his sunglasses and his hat, and he is 1,000 times more chill than you are. And you look in his face and you're like, you're Rick Mears. And he's like, uh-huh. And the whole conversation is just him saying the casual things like, you know, I never put it in the fence until blah, 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 but this is what happens. And the mistake guys make is yada, yada, blah. And you might as well be talking to, like, I mean, I don't know. I think I had a similar conversation in a similar tone with the last guy who came to snake out my drains in my shower, right? You know, I've met plumbers who get more, like, into and worked up about their work and are less chill when talking about problems they've run into. And the guys, that's the one constant thread. I know you've seen this, but the guys who are the well and truly great dudes, the one echelon above ordinary super talents, that even, you know, guys who stand out even at the top of the sport, where there are a bunch of guys who stand out, those dudes are always just ordinary people. And, you know, with few exceptions, most of them are not jerks. And when you find somebody that's not a jerk and has some perspective and is willing to talk to you, it ends up being the names you think that it's going to be. And listening to those dudes, the Santa analogy is a great one. You're just like, you put your chin in your hands and you just keep thinking of questions, and the questions, there's always too many questions and not enough time. And it's a privilege, man. I mean, it's because the good ones are, you know, the good ones are amazing, and they're as human as it gets. Which is funny, because on the other end of the spectrum, like, you know, so much of the sport has turned into churning out robotic dudes who just, you know, utter sponsor names and say, well, you know, we didn't have the result we wanted for today, and but
I remember when we were standing on pit lane before session, or maybe I don't remember the exact circumstances at Indy, and we bumped into Bourdais, and he was mentioning how he would love to try lapping
in the rain,
Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the rain. And you and I just both looked at each other like, Where do they make the... Where are these people still made? I don't, you know... I didn't know France had a version of Evel Knievel. Are you freaking kidding, Bourdais? But again, I just... It's those little things where I love watching your face light up, or even mine, you know, where you go, that's the best thing in the world right there. Just folks who... We already marvel at their ability to do things we can't, but then the fact that even for them, you know, going, hey, you just stepped out of a vehicle traveling an average of 220-something miles per hour, and now you're standing next to that vehicle 5 minutes later, your head isn't spinning, you aren't about to fall over from dizziness, you're able to compose full sentences, and now you're actually dreaming of scenarios where as if the thing you just did wasn't out of reach from the rest of humanity by a wide enough margin. Now you're just curious, like, yeah, you know, I'd actually like to give this place a go on frickin', you know, on wets in the rain. You go,
Well, do you remember, so that year there was rain in the forecast, but it was one of those days where, you know, there's massive wind kicking up and all the guys are fighting loose cars. And the walking, I remember walking up and down pit wall with you, and the guys that were hopping out of cars and pulling their helmets off were split into two groups. There was the dudes who were like, yeah, it's a race car, and we just did some race car stuff. And then there were the guys who had eyes big as dinner plates that had very clearly, like, just backed the car into a corner at a buck 90 or two, whatever, and were super not cool with it, and were really just kind of, like, wondering if maybe they should take up another sport, like competitive baking or, you know, training house cats. And we walked up to Bourdais, and there had been rain in the forecast, or maybe it started to rain, I don't remember. And you had done this thing, it was entertaining the hell out of me, where you were just asking every driver we ran into, and you walked down that row, and you run into a driver every 15 feet, if they would run around the speedway in the rain. And most of them were like, eh, maybe. And one guy was like, I would not do it, but I would like it. And there were a couple of younger guys who very vehemently said, hell no. And Bourdais, because he's Bourdais, just kind of sat there and he thought for a second and he blinked behind his glasses and he looked at you and he went, I would do it, yes. And there was just this, like, in the same way that you would, it's like if you asked me to go up to McDonald's and get you a soda and I'm like, yeah, I mean, I don't want to leave my desk, but sure, why not? I like Marshall, I'll help you out. I would rip around that place at 200 whatever in the wet. Sure, why not? And I just remember looking at you and you looked at me and it was like, what? It was great.
We found one. We got one. Oh, Lord. Well, one of the other things that you and I do from time to time is revel in how much we hate either a certain series or things about racing that we think just needs to die an immediate and painful death. I know your chronicles of attending a Formula E race, if you ever want to speak of a champion... For the common man, that was Sam Smith attending a Formula E race and reporting back, it's everything you thought it wasn't. I realize that they're introducing a new generation of car this year, and there's many changes that should improve the goodness-ish of it in year five or whatever it is. But electrification, quiet cars, racing vehicles and whatnot... Is Formula E still that thing that offends all of the carbon-burning demons inside of you? Or what comes to mind is a series where you say, okay, with your death, racing gets better. Not necessarily more modern or more responsible, but just more pure.
I don't know, right? I mean, I have this silly little disease where I like anything... with an engine that seems like an untamable beast that, you know, goes fast in some form or fashion, and at some point somebody has to put their life on the line to make it a real dramatic piece of human accomplishment. And the funny thing about Formula E is that everything I just said both applies and doesn't. I mean, I remember sitting there. It's the only race I've ever been to where halfway, and this was Long Beach, the second season, I guess?
Yeah, I think
first
so.
First season, I don't remember. It's the only race I've ever been to where halfway through the prime show, the weekend-ending show with the A-listers in it, halfway through it, A, attendance was free, but B, halfway through, half of those people who had paid nothing to be there got up and walked out. The stands literally emptied about halfway through the race. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, and it was an interesting thought exercise, right? Because on the surface, I mean, I'm not a Luddite. Everything needs to, you know, everything moves along a curve. We're all evolving towards something. And the cars are going to be electric, wherever that electricity comes from. You know, if you ignore what's happening next in automobiles, you have your head in the sand. But you sit there and you watch an FE race, and the loudest noise you hear is the clatter of bodywork over the curbs. And it doesn't sound expensive. It doesn't sound amazing or awe-inspiring, because a really light carbon fiber race car is going to sound like a big empty piece of plastic when it goes clattering over a concrete curb. And they run on street tires, which, great, you think, okay, the cars slide a lot, you know, it makes the guys put some yaw into the thing, and, you know, there's lockup, and then they're fighting for grip and all this other stuff. But at the end of the day, all that means really is that the guys slide a little on exit, and you hear tire squeal along with the echoey, clattery carbon plastic box. And ultimately, it got me thinking about everything we factor into our spectacle, right? And how much with motorsport, the big, loud, untamable beast is part of the draw. You want to see guys doing a thing, guys, gals, women, animals, whatever you are, whoever is in the cockpit, you want to see them doing something you can't in a way that seems impossible, right? Not just, oh, you know, with 20 years of practice, I could be that good, but with 20 years of practice, I would be half that good, and I also wouldn't have as many balls, right? And Formula E just, it was a, you know, I know they're trying, and I know there's a lot of money in it, and the manufacturers are throwing a lot of weight behind it. Good for them, and I want to get into it, and man, I just can't. And maybe that means I'm getting older, but it's just the spectacle. It's not even rooted in the fuel. It's just the fact that I can't get excited watching it.
There are pills for that, Sam, but it's a bit of an odd expectation from a motor racing series.
Motor racing may cause incontinence, sleeplessness, depression, antidepressant.
Yes. No
list of side effects a mile long.
Oh, Lord. I think we should stop talking and save whatever we want to talk about for a next Marshall and Sam blabber and talk about things because they talk words out of their faces podcast. So tell me a little bit more about what folks can do to watch them, some proving grounds if they don't catch it, say following a Yeehaw 500 or some of the other methods they can get it. I have enjoyed it. Despite your participation in it, it's something that I enjoyed, despite the fact that we're pals. But I'm hoping some other folks will watch it, not because we're pals, but just because I think they too would like it because it's different.
Well, thanks. So the show airs, Proving Grounds airs every Sunday after a Yeehaw 500, or if you don't have cable, it's your cutter, which oddly enough I am. I had to figure out how to stream it. It's streamable through Hulu Live or the NBC Sports app, which should pop up in all of the digital TV boxes, and also is available on your phone. Generally falls under the NASCAR category because that's how NBC groups it. So you just go to that heading, and there should be episodes and episodes of us being goonballs in the desert. But other than that, I'm in Road and Track column every month, usually a feature every month, all over the website pretty regularly, on Twitter and Instagram, like everybody else. But other than that, I think I've answered your question. Was that the whole question? I feel like that was the whole question.
I believe so. I believe you've properly given a proper account of who you are and where you can be found.
And that was Sam Smith, he of Road and Track fame, he of growing Proving Grounds fame. He's going to want a booking fee next time. Sam Smith, again. I have the most immense love-hate for that person. If he was less talented, I'd like him even more, because then I wouldn't be constantly reminded of how much I suck in comparison. But I learned to embrace, you know, we all are different in different ways. I mean, Sam probably couldn't pick up a refrigerator. I can, so who knows? Maybe that's a trade. All-time gifted writer in the area of automotive and motor racing. Guy who can pick up and put down heavy things. Maybe that's just the way our lots and lives have played out. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. Thank you for listening.